part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Bill Clinton's speechwriters came up with a slogan in 1991 that one pollster called pure heroin. The slogan, end welfare as we know it. Eventually, the slogan would become policy. Millions of women and children left the welfare rolls. On the program today, a discussion about welfare. Our guest is New York Times reporter Jason DeParle. For 7 years, he tracked one family's struggle to make ends meet without welfare. He tells the story of this family in the book American Dream, 3 Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. After introducing readers to the three women, Angie Jobe, Jewel Reed, and Opal Caples, DeParle tells us something about his beat at the New York Times. Now and then, he says, at a social event, someone asks me what I do. If I don't feel like talking, I tell the truth. I say, I cover social policy for the New York Times. And the conversation moves on. In a more adventurous mood, I tell the truth in a different way. I say, I cover welfare. That keeps the table boiling. Say the word welfare, and there's no telling what might bubble up. Bill Clinton started one of those conversations on the fly in a campaign season, and what bubbled up was a free-for-all and an end to welfare more radical than anyone had imagined. He then writes about how the discussion usually runs at that boiling, roiling table and makes this observation. We live in a country where anyone can make it, yet generation after generation, some families don't. To argue about welfare is to argue about why. Listeners, I invite your questions for our guest, Jason DeParle, this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Jason DeParle, a senior writer at The Times and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He was awarded a George Polk Award in 1999 and has twice been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on welfare. His book, American Dream, is published by Viking. Jason DeParle, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
When you began looking at welfare through the lives of these three women, what did you learn about welfare? What surprises were there for you, someone who had covered welfare for a number of years?
Probably the biggest surprise is that welfare played a smaller part in the women's lives than I guessed going into it. You know, I was coming from a Washington policy environment where the conversation was about welfare. This was a law written about welfare. And the assumption on both sides, the left and the right, was that welfare was crucial, was the center of the women's lives. The left worried that without welfare, poor families would be blown to the wind, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan said. They'd be left to sleep on grates. They couldn't get by. And the right said, without welfare, these people will straighten up their lives, clean up their acts. Everything would be okay. It's welfare that's damaging them. I think both sides exaggerated the just how potent a force welfare was. At one point, I was asking Angie 10 welfare questions in a row. This, what did you think about this law or that rule or this new change? And she finally just looked at me and said, "Jason, that's your crazy stuff. You know, I wasn't thinking about welfare." And it really was true. Welfare just was smaller economically in her life than I would have guessed, and smaller in an emotional sense.
Yeah, you're asked this question all the time. I'm sure. Have the sweeping changes to welfare enacted in 1996 been a success or a failure?
A big success in putting women like Angie to work. Once tougher welfare laws came along, she Angie had been on welfare for 12 years. She had no high school education. She had four kids. But within 6 months of the new law, she had left the roles and had a full-time job as a nursing aide. She was much more able to work than skeptics of the law predicted, and I include myself among them. So it was a great success as an employment prod for people to go get jobs. The bad news is the jobs didn't raise her income, so it was not a particularly successful measure as an anti-poverty program. It put the people to work, but the people stayed poor. And perhaps most disappointingly, it didn't do much for her children, if anything. I think the big hope for, the most idealistic hope among the people who wrote the new law was that when women went to work, their children would be launched on new trajectories, would have more promising lives, would buckle down in school, wouldn't get pregnant as teenagers, would see the importance of an education, and both in the social science literature more broadly and in the families I followed, that just didn't happen.
Yeah. One of the problems there is there's less supervision at home.
Right. I mean, one of the ideas is that women like Angie would become role models for their children by working, but I think just what you said, that her children experienced her job more as an absence than an inspiration. They didn't think, hey, gee, mom's working, I'm going to do my part by buckling down in school. They thought, you know, gosh, she's not around. A, I wish she was, because there's problems in the house that she could take care of. Or B, she's gone, so I can drink, or I can smoke, or I can get involved with the boy down the street because mom's not around to keep an eye on me.
Yeah. What would you like to tell our listeners here at the outset about the other two women in American Dream?
The three women are cousins.
Okay.
So it's really the story of one extended family.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what was interesting to me is that they start in the same place, both literally and figuratively, but they get launched on different trajectories and they wind up in very different places. So they start in the same place in the sense that they're three single mothers, they're African-American women living together in a central city community. They had adjacent apartments in a subdivided old Victorian mansion, so they literally lived together, you know, as housemates. But over time, they follow different paths. Angie, the main character of the book, is very dedicated to her work as a nursing aide and really thinks she can work her way out of her poverty, out of her predicament. She becomes a kind of a vehicle for thinking and about the low-wage economy and what life is like for people who toil in it. Jewel, the second cousin, works as much and as successfully as Angie, but she doesn't really care about work. She doesn't have her heart invested in it. She has her heart invested in a man. His name is Ken Thigpen, and he was a drug dealer and also a pimp. And so I thought, you know, when I was first watching her story unfold, I was thinking, like, God, this is just not a good place for you to put your heart, Jewel. This is not a good bet to make. In time, to my great surprise, that bet paid off. Ken gave up his street life and wound up getting a job. But that's, you know, at the end of the story. And Opal, the third cousin, was the smartest and most charismatic and most advantaged in conventional terms. She had only one of the three who had a high school degree. She even had a couple semesters at community college. I thought Opal was going to be the big success of the three. What I didn't understand is that Opal was addicted to drugs, and she had a fall through the Wisconsin welfare system more tragic than I would have guessed possible at the outset.
Yeah. The women move from Chicago to Milwaukee, and they're arriving there in October in the fall of 1991. And not long after they get there, you say the city became the epicenter of the anti-welfare crusade, that it became the world's most famous welfare eradication zone.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story there?
Well, in their coming, or in the abolition of welfare in Wisconsin?
Both, I guess. What motivated them to move to Milwaukee? And
what happened in Milwaukee? Yeah. I sometimes think of this story as one of those maritime disaster movies. You know, I mean, on the one hand, you have the gathering storm, set off by Bill Clinton's pledge to end welfare. And on the other hand, you have the three women sailing obliviously into the center of it, you know, with no idea that bad welfare weather hangs over the horizon. They had been on welfare in Chicago, but the real way they were paying their rent was through their boyfriends who were selling drugs. The check in Chicago, rents were so high and checks were sufficiently modest that you couldn't rent an apartment even if you put your whole check toward it. So the way they paid the rent was through the boyfriends. Their boyfriends went to jail in the summer of 1991, just as Bill Clinton was pledging to end welfare. And they moved to Milwaukee, which had higher checks and lower rents. So in Milwaukee, you could get an apartment and still have a little bit of money left over. That's all they knew about Milwaukee when they got on the bus to go. And certainly didn't know that 3 or 4 or 5 years later, as was the case, Milwaukee became the first major city in the country to pass tough work rules and require welfare recipients to work for their checks. So Milwaukee became the kind of policy laboratory that the rest of the world looked to as the first example of radical cuts in the welfare rolls.
Yeah, and also governor at the time, Republican Tommy Thompson, he had as one of his great priorities was to cut welfare.
Yeah, well, Tommy Thompson ran on an anti-welfare platform in 1986 when he was first when he first elected, but he really didn't do much in terms of welfare in his first two terms. He had some very highly publicized but modest experiments. So on the ground, in terms of the welfare system, nothing had really changed 5 years later when Angie and Opal and Jewel arrived in 1991. But then in 1992, Bill Clinton was elected on a pledge to end welfare, and that set off a kind of social policy arms race. Once a liberal Democratic candidate had said he was going to end welfare, it gave license to Republicans and conservatives to, in essence, to put forward tougher laws, and that's what happened in 1996.
Hmm. How did that slogan, end welfare as we know it, become such a critical part of Clinton's campaign?
It's an interesting story because the first time Bill Clinton used that phrase, October 23rd, 1991, no one noticed. The New York Times didn't cover his speech. The Washington Post did cover his speech, but focused on a different phrase, his soon-forgotten pledge to create a new covenant. But over time, those words, end welfare as we know it, took on a life of their own. It was a kind of magical phrase that just got set down in the course of a brainstorming session one Saturday night. Bill Clinton was running as a dark horse candidate for the Democratic nomination. It's 13 months before the election. You know, he's an obscure governor of Arkansas. He's trying to get some notice, so they bandy about some what they thought were catchy phrases, and they came up with end welfare as we know it. What's a stroke of genius about the phrase is end welfare, the first two words, sounds so definite and bold. It sounds like a money-saving promise. It sounds like a get-tough promise. It's ramrod straight, end welfare. But then the rest of the phrase, as we know it, is a qualifying that could really mean anything. Well, we'll end welfare as we know it. You could rearrange the chairs and you would have ended welfare as you know it. So I think liberals heard it as a kind of ironic wink, hey, don't worry, we're not really going to get too tough here. You know, conservatives were able to read a tough message into it. Liberals were able to read a knowing wink into it. It was an all-meaning phrase for everybody.
Yeah. So it resonated with everybody. But Clinton, as you point out at the beginning of the book, he wondered if it went too far, but he climbed onto the bandwagon, didn't he?
Well, Clinton had a long history of experimenting with welfare programs in Arkansas. So it wasn't as though the phrase was entirely... The phrase itself was plucked out of the ether, but Clinton's interest in the issue was not. Clinton had, for years, been interested in welfare policy long before he ran for governor. He was the chairman of the National Governors Association and its leader on welfare issues. He was looking for a clever slogan to run on. It wasn't that he invented an interest in the issue. He had the interest in the issue. He was looking for a new way to package it But I think that packaging with the end welfare phrase took on a life of its own and blew him in a different direction. I mean, I think if he had promised to change welfare as we know it, mend welfare as we know it, you know, bend it, anything other than end it, would have you wouldn't have had quite the radical impetus to completely overhaul the system.
Going into it, what was his critique of welfare?
He had a substantive critique, as everyone did, that the system wasn't doing enough to get people, that it was a maintenance system. It left you in poverty. It didn't do enough to get you to better your circumstance. But I think he also had a political vision in the good sense. I mean, there was a way in which he had a self-interested political vision that he wanted to end welfare because it was a good vote-getting issue. But in a deeper sense, I think he felt like the welfare system had become an albatross around the neck of the Democratic Party, around the cause of progressive politics more broadly, that as long as voters could point at welfare as a symbol of what they didn't like about the Democratic Party, about the big government, you know, the cause of the politics of poverty would be hampered by that. If you could redefine the issue so that poor people were seen as workers, not shirkers, a more generous politics of poverty would flow. I think that was Clinton's vision at its best.
Yeah.
And I think it half came true. You know, we just went through the 2004 election cycle. You just didn't hear politicians beating up on poor people and welfare recipients the way they did 10 years ago. You know, in the 1994 midterm congressional elections, even Ted Kennedy was running workfare ads as part of his re-election campaign. We just went through a cycle where there was almost none of that. On the other, so you know, Clinton was half right in the sense that he removed a lot of the anger about poverty from politics. On the other hand, kind of removed the subject. We've sort of removed the subject of poverty from politics. You know, nobody was talking about poor people at all, one way or the other, in the last election campaign.
Yeah. When you wrap up American Dream, you write about this. You say that on the one hand, George W. Bush has run as a compassionate conservative. On the other hand, we don't talk very much in our political conversation, our dialogue, our discussion in this country about the problems, the issues facing people who earn low wages.
And that was the second part of Clinton's hope for the bill, was once you saw the poor as workers, not shirkers, a more generous politics would ensue and there'd be more help, more concern, more programs, more perhaps a more equitable distribution of income and wealth. And you know, none of that has flowed.
Hmm. What do you think, from your vantage point, after spending all this time looking at the issue on the, you know, within the stories of these very real women, you know, living this life as people who are really scraping to get by? What do you think could be done to help lift low-wage workers, to improve their situation?
Well, the DePauw plan generally has four bullet points. One of them is to I think poor women like Angie need ongoing subsidies. They can't command enough of a wage where they are to get by without some government help. So the notion of making people self-sufficient, I think, is a misnomer. I mean, what you want somebody like Angie to do is to get off of public aid and work, but she's still going to need continued subsidies for things like the child care and health insurance and wage subsidies in the form of the earned income tax credit. You have to preserve and hopefully fortify some sort of work-based safety net. That would be point number two. Point number one. Point number two is try to provide some sort of venue for on-the-job training so that women like her who are stuck in these low-skilled jobs can advance while they're working. Point number three, her kids have absolutely no place to go after school, and they were just chronically, chronically bored. You know, when my affluent friends get together, when we talk about kids, everybody complains about how overscheduled their kids' lives are, you know, running from Taekwondo to the birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese to the piano lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Angie's kids just lived in a in a world where there was never anything to do, and in a very dangerous neighborhood where the prospects for diverting yourself were unfortunate and you know, potentially self-destructive ones. So my third point, I guess, is to strengthen some sort of after-school care so that just so those kids could have some place to go, be safe, and be mentally engaged with the world instead of roaming the streets or just sitting in the house the way they did. But none of those first three things, I think, compare in terms of the importance, I'd say, with the fourth, and that is we've got to do something to re-engage the men
mm-hmm.
in their lives in some sort of productive way. The subtitle of the book is Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare.
Mm-hmm.
None of the three women and none of the ten kids grew up with a stable father in the house. They all identified it to me at some point as a source of loss or grief or sadness in their lives. I mean, the welfare bill is essentially a law that focuses on one gender, the women. And until we find a way to raise the earnings of the men and reconnect them with the children and the mothers of the children, I don't think we're going to see substantial progress in the inner city.
Mm-hmm. Any ideas for programs for men? Is there any discussion out there about this issue?
There is not a lot, but there's a little. There's actually some bipartisan interest in the Senate. Senator Rick Santorum on the GOP and Senator Evan Bayh, your neighbor from Indiana, have a fatherhood bill that would put a small amount of money into a mixture of programs for low-income men. There was a kind of bubbling bit of interest in the late 1990s. It sort of fizzled out for lack of funding, but it's still there on the horizon.
Hmm.
And the way I think of it is, I mean, the bad news is the men I met in and out of the lives of the Angie, Opal, and Jewel, the three women I followed, were even more disadvantaged than they were. I mean, almost all of them were selling drugs. Almost all of them had prison records. Very few of them had formal work experience of any size or substance. I mean, they were really bad off. On the other hand, they seemed more appealing than I would have expected. You know, you would typically hear them described as deadbeat dads or cavalier guys who were hit-and-run dads who had had children and abandoned them, but it seemed less like deadbeats to me than sort of wounded, abandoned sons who had always promised they wouldn't do the same things to their kids, even as they were doing them. You know, there seemed to be more potential and more desire in them to sort of be better providers, better people, more productive people than they were. And as I said, the great redemption story in the book is this drug dealer and pimp, Ken Thigpen, who turns his life around and in the end has a son and takes a job as a pizza delivery man and becomes something of the model dad in the extended family.
Yeah. What turned him around?
You know, as far as I can tell, it's a two-part answer. And one is it's part carrot and part stick. And the carrot is the old-fashioned carrot of jail. He just he spent a lot of time in jail. He went back for 2 years. Shortly after I met Jewel, he went away for 2 years, and he just got tired of being in jail. Number one, but even then, he was still quite tempted to go back to his old way of life. I think the carrot in his story was Jewel herself. She waited 2 years for him. When all her friends said, oh, give up on it, it won't be there for you, you'd be crazy to wait. And as Ken said something to me along the lines of, when you've got a good woman behind you, you can't help but do positive things or something like that. He had something to go to, in other words. She was working. She had built a little home. So it wasn't just the stick of prison, but he was in a position where he could make a positive choice, and I think it was the combination of those two things together. And then the birth of the son really sealed it for me. Once he had his son, he definitely did not want to go back to prison.
Yeah. The men that you talk to, how do they talk about their children, and what do they see with what's wrong and why it's wrong and what's good? And
well, part of what's striking is how they talk about their, not so much their children, but their own fathers. You know, I mean, they tell the stories about their fathers that one would imagine their kids are telling about them. You know, I went to a class once for guys who had fallen behind on their child support, and they had to write their own obituaries from the standpoint of the kids they barely knew. So in other words, and then they had to read them to the class. So these guys, one after another, were imagining what their 3-year-old and 6-year-old and 10-year-old and 17-year-old kids would say about them at their funeral. And it was, you know, almost always begin, well, I didn't really know him, but. And it really shook them up, in part, I think, because they had been in that position themselves of, you know, having been that way with their own, feeling that kind of anger towards their own fathers, not really knowing their own fathers.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is New York Times senior writer Jason DeParle, author of American Dream, 3 Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. I invite your questions and comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Charleston on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I would ask your guests this question. The discussion of these things and the subject matter of this moment to me represent symptoms of a larger issue. And what would your guests say to that?
Which larger issue?
Of welfare and its causes and its perpetuation.
Well, if you want to talk about causation, at least in terms of the family, I wrote about the layers are numerous. I actually set out to write a book about Milwaukee in the late 1990s. The book now starts in Mississippi in 1843. It traces the family history back 6 generations to a common ancestor in slavery, and a man named Frank Caples, who was brought into Mississippi as a child slave by an Alabama slaveholder, and talks about his life in slavery and his emancipation and his birth of his son's life in Reconstruction. And his son was recruited to be a sharecropper by the father of an infamous Mississippi segregationist named James Eastland. The family spent 3 decades on the Eastland plantation as sharecroppers. Moved up to Chicago right at the beginnings of the deindustrialization as Chicago and then Milwaukee lost half their manufacturing jobs. So you have centuries of racial injustice and exclusion. You have huge economic forces, and then you have decades of government social policy. All these things helped shape the story.
Caller still there?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I would go reiterate that this is not totally racial. I'm assuming that the subjects of your book were black. Is that correct?
Yes, they are.
Yes. Okay. Well, then you moved that back to 1847. And in the 1850s and 60s, I think, began the migration of the Irish. I mean, they were here a long time before that, but the new wave came after the potato famine, and then they were roundly hated by those already established here, who were graded into 3 classes. You know, you had the working class, and it's like that to this day, the upper, middle, and lower, and then the people below them represent those who do not fit in, either racially or ethnically, or the job market that requires a higher standard of expertise, which is happening now. If you don't know electronics and how to get by in the world that has moved from a assembly line status to one that is technological, then we are doomed. That's what I meant by the root causes of what we experience in welfare.
Yeah. So essentially what you're asking is for our guest, Jason DeParle, to comment on class in America.
Yes, and the economic fallout from that.
Okay.
Right. That's what I was. The book does discuss the collapse of deindustrialization and the loss of manufacturing jobs. With I think it's slightly over half of the manufacturing jobs in Chicago disappeared in the three decades right before the families moved up from Mississippi. So they were moving. Historically, people could come to the industrial north and get those jobs and earn a family-supporting wage with few skills. That no longer became the pathway out of poverty, just as they were moving in. And there was a much greater premium put on education and the higher skills that they didn't have. That is one of the many layers of the story, yes.
Yeah. Welfare, aid to families with dependent children, goes back to the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
What should we know about its history that would be something that we should know to keep in mind to help us understand where we are today?
Well, AFDC, the old welfare system, when it was created in the Depression, it was never created to support the population it came to support. It was created in an age, number one, where women were expected to stay at home, not in an age when women were expected to go to work. So that's one big difference. The other big difference, it was created to support really widows of and white people. There was explicit rejection of anti-discrimination language early on because the Southern congressional delegation didn't want to pass a law that would allow black women to draw a government check and leave the field. They were protecting their source of cheap labor. So really what the program was supposed to do was to support widows of workers injured in industrial accidents. And the notion was that over time, as Social Security grew up, workers would pay into Social Security, so their survivors would be covered through the Social Security system. And in the phrase that was often used at the time, welfare would wither away. Well, of course, it didn't wither away, and it became a program not that supported women who had been married but who had lost their husbands in industrial accidents, but it became a program that supported increasingly women who had never been married and who were forming families, having kids outside of wedlock.
Mm.
That was part of why the public disliked it so much.
Mm.
It had lost in the public's eyes its kind of moral basis.
Yeah. Well, there is a fourth woman in this story, I think, and her name is Hattie Mae Crenshaw,
mm-hmm.
And she was the first in the family to receive a welfare check.
But, she's Jewel's mother, yes.
Yes, that's correct. Okay, and you write that this was something that was really good for Hattie Crenshaw. I mean, it helped her, right? She didn't see it as
Hattie Mae is one of the most remarkable women I've ever met as a journalist. One day she came up to Jewel's house for a visit, and I asked her unsuspectingly, "Oh, Miss Crenshaw, tell me where you're from." She answered with a sentence that utterly stopped me in my tracks. She said, "Jason, I was born on Senator Jim Eastland's plantation in Doddsville, Mississippi in 1937. That's a time when black peoples was just beginning to come out of slavery." And you know, I just looked at her and I thought, what in the world is she talking about? Slavery, number one, is 1937, but number two, James Eastland, it's a name that will mean a lot to some of your listeners and maybe nothing to others. Eastland was one of the last great segregationists of the white supremacists of the South. He used to go around boasting he had a vest pocket where all the civil rights bills went to die. You know, and I was wondering, was Hattie Mae really from this plantation? Was was just something she'd heard in the family. It was all true. She had been born and raised on the Eastland plantation. I went down to the plantation. I met her uncle, who was still living there. The plantation was still in the Eastland family name. So she's the kind of historical bridge in the family back to the rural South. And she was born and raised picking cotton in the Eastland plantation, suffered a sexual abuse at the hands of older black men and economic abuse at the hands of white men who ran the plantation in terms of getting cheated out of her, routinely cheated out of her wages. So when welfare came along and she could go on welfare at age 20, while welfare has always been called been criticized for making women dependent, mm-hmm. for Hattie it was a great source of independence. It got her out of the fields where she was subject to this exploitative labor market, and it got her out of a very abusive man's home where he had been beating her. So mm-hmm. she initially looked at it as a great blessing.
A way out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line 2. Hi.
Hello, I'm calling. This is a question I'm going to ask is intended as a critical question, even though it may have a ring of antagonism associated with it. Am I correct in assuming that all your case studies are African-American women in your book?
It's one family, three women. Yes, it's an African-American family.
Well, don't you run the risk of perpetuating a stereotypical notion in this country that welfare and blacks are synonymous concepts?
Well, the reason I chose an African-American, well, there's two reasons. One, it was kind of happenstance. I didn't choose to write about an African-American family. I chose to write about Milwaukee because Milwaukee was the city in the country that was the first and boldest place that ended welfare.
You're saying there are no whites on welfare in Milwaukee?
I'd say about 70% of the welfare population in Milwaukee is African-American.
What about the 30%?
So the typical Milwaukee welfare family was an African-American family that had parents or grandparents from Chicago or Mississippi. So the family that I wrote about, the Caples family, is quite typical of a Milwaukee family. I came to think, you know, initially I wondered about the same question you're asking about, is this a stereotype? If so, is it, you know, a damaging one? But I came to think it was actually an advantage to try to write about an African-American family because race was so deeply intertwined with the story that of welfare, that so much of the political anger, the reason welfare was so unpopular, had to do with people's with its racialization, with the sense that white voters had that it was an accurate sense that it disproportionately went to black recipients, that blacks were overrepresented as a percentage of the population. So that, you know, if you were really going to write about the politics of this issue, you know, it was an advantage to write about an African American family.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to another.
Yeah, if I could just amplify on that a little bit, you know, I quote in the book, having written about welfare for 10 years at the New York Times, I got to some of the most vile, racially bitter, awful letters. And I quote here and there a little bit of them. It goes to show just how much ongoing, you know, sometimes people say, gee, we shouldn't be bringing racial history into that. We're all past that. But, you know, when you read some of just the hate mail I got about welfare and how racial it was, I think it reminds you of how much of a substantial part of the drive to end welfare was really a drive, was driven from anti-black feelings. And I think the whole plantation history of the Eastland family, it reminds you how recent that is mm-hmm. in Hattie Mae's life. I mean, Hattie Mae's not an old woman. She's Jewel's mother. I mean, she's only a half generation older than me, and yet she was raised in these almost, you know, near slave-like conditions as a sharecropper. And if you're going to understand her world view, there's a notion in America, anybody, you know, hard work brings a good day's pay, anybody can make it. Well, that was a ludicrous notion for her growing up as a child on the plantation where, you know, a hard day's wage meant you got cheated at the end of the day. So you know, race was just entwined in the story in a thousand ways, and I thought it was actually advantageous to the book to deal with it head on.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm a doctoral student in social work here at the university, and I will begin writing a dissertation on welfare reform and the way states have packaged support services to the poor over the last 10 years. And in relation to that, I'd like for Mr. DePauw to talk a little bit about the welfare funding mechanism and the surpluses that were created by the caseload declines and what states might have done with the extra money and what possibilities could abound in terms of identifying the needs of low-income workers and helping to really do what the policy was supposed to do and making
more pay. One of the great ironies of the welfare bill is that the conservative Republicans who crafted it were setting out to cut welfare funding. So they flattened, in the past, the more people you had, the more people a state had on the caseload, the more they could get from the federal government. The federal government, you know, paid a certain percentage of every new case. Under the new law, they went to something called, the old law was called an entitlement, the new law is called a block grant. The federal government gave each state a flat amount and said, here's what you get no matter what your caseload is, you know, manage it as best you can. That was supposed to be a funding cut because in the past, caseloads had gone up and up and up, so you'd be getting the same amount of money but required to serve more people. Now the caseloads took a U-turn. They collapsed. They went way, way down. So states were getting more money per person than they would have. You know, their funding stayed flat even as the caseloads dropped. So in other words, the states in the late 90s, when everyone was expecting they were going to be taking a funding hit, suddenly had these huge surpluses. And your caller asks, gee, what did they do with them? The answer is all over the map. A few states did some innovative things and funded kinds of programs that they couldn't have funded in the past. They funded transportation subsidies, made it easier for people to buy cars, to put a little bit of money here and there into wage subsidies. A lot of states just pocketed the money and used it to cut state spending. They played games with the books using their federal, put your federal resources towards programs that you used to fund with state dollars and then put the state dollars into a tax cut. And most states did a mixture of both things, but I would say by and large that opportunity, states failed to take advantage of this huge opportunity that they had.
Hmm. Boy, that's really an interesting story in and of itself, isn't it?
Well, you know, some states you get into the very intricacies of state budgeting, and in some places it's very hard to follow the money trail and figure out exactly what the states do with the money. But others, like Minnesota, spelled it out in budget documents. They actually had a drawing where you had the federal welfare surplus dollars coming in, and state money being backed out and going back as a tax cut. So roads got built, bridges got built, you know, schools got repainted, property taxes got cut. All sorts of things happened on the federal welfare nickel that didn't involve new services for poor people. Mm. But here and there, there were some new services for poor people as well. Actually, I neglected to say a lot of it got spent on what did, of that amount that did go to low-income families, a lot of it went to child care.
Okay.
That was probably the favorite state thing to spend the surplus money on in terms of anti-poverty spending.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We've got to wrap up here. I wanted to ask you about the kids of these three women. The oldest, now born in 1984, is going to be in her 20s.
Keisha, yes.
And
21 in May.
And other of the kids are in their teen years. How are they doing?
Keisha dropped out of high school in 10th grade. She got pregnant, dropped out of high school. She had a second baby, so she's now 20 years old. She has two kids. But she didn't go on welfare. She works. She took a job as a checkout clerk at a grocery store, Jewel Osco grocery store, and has a boyfriend. Lives with her boyfriend and her two young babies, and is a attentive mother and working, but sort of setting down her own mother's hard path of single motherhood. It was a disappointment to Angie to see that her oldest child got got pregnant, basically at the same age Angie did. Her younger brother, Red, also dropped out of high school. He now works at Burger King. And there's two younger kids who are still in school. So that's part of where I say that the hopes of the welfare reformers that tougher welfare laws would set the kids on a new path is not particularly borne out in this story. It's not particularly borne out in the larger literature either. Both of Angie's oldest two kids ended up leaving high school and still struggling.
Yeah, so we're back to some changes for the better and some changes for some promise.
Well, tell Angie's story as though it was a great transformation. This goes back to your earlier question about how much did welfare figure in her life. On the one hand, you could say she's off the rolls, on the job. Angie even wound up with a 401k. You know, if I told you that after 12 years somebody left welfare, had a 401k, you would think, gosh, what a great success story. On the other hand, 10 years ago she was a low-income single mother raising kids by herself in a dangerous inner-city neighborhood, and now she's, for all her hard work and all her struggle and strife, she's a low-income woman raising kids by herself, you know, single mother in a dangerous inner-city neighborhood. So you have to, I think, to fully understand her story, keep both of those thoughts in mind, because both of them are elements. There's a part of her element that really, of her story that really is an unlikely triumph, and there's a part of it where, you know, heartbreakingly less changes than one would hope.
There we have to leave it. Jason, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Jason DeParle has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He's the author of American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and A Nation's Drive to End Welfare. The book is published by Viking. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished like this in the bean pit, anywhere between one higher in the far deferreds to up 6 in the nearby March contract. Our own Dave Dickey tells me that was some bull spreading that was happening throughout the day as he was watching the markets all day long. And we'll talk with the folks at L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, to see whether that was actually truly the case. I'm quite certain that they will say, yes, Dave's right on that one. So we'll take a look at that at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. That's only just a few minutes away here. Let's start in the wheat pit for the afternoon. March contract in the wheat at 298 and three-quarter high, low at $2.95. Their settlement price at $2.97. They finished a penny and three quarters higher for the day. The May futures now 305.5 the high, the low at 302.5, settled $3.04, up 1.75. July futures, harvest month, up a penny and three quarters with a settlement price at $3.11.5, the high at 312.75, and July's low at 309.5 for the soft red winter wheat in Chicago. September futures, 317.5 the high, the low at 315, settlement price at $3.17. They were up 2 in the December contract, a penny higher, 327 high, low at 324.5, settled 324.75 once again. That December contract was up 1 for the day. The March corn, $1.99.75, the high, not quite making the $2 level, $1.97 the low, settlement price $1.99, up a penny and a quarter. The May futures, 207 the high, the low at 204.5. Settlement price at 206.75. They were up a penny and a half. In July futures, 214 the high, low at 211.25. Settlement price $2.13.75, up 1.75. September futures, 221.25 a bushel, the high, the low at 219.5, and a bushel of corn for the September settled at $2.20.75. That's $2.20.75 of a cent, up a penny. December futures up 1.25, 230.25 the settlement price, with a high of 230.75, a low at 228.75, and the March contract a narrow trading range there as well, 238.25 high, low at 236.75, settled 237.75. They were up a penny and a quarter. March oats for the day, 168.5 high, low at 166, a settlement price at $1.68 even, down a penny, and the May futures were unchanged at $1.57 for the oats. March futures in the bean pit now, 528 the high, the low at $5.15.5, settled a lot closer to the high end at $5.26, up 6 cents for the March soybeans. May futures up 3.75, 525.25 to the high, the low at 515.5. Once again, settled 3.75 higher in the May beans at $5.24. July contract now 529.5 the high, the low at 520.5, settled at 528, 2.5 higher, and the August soybeans were up a penny and a half at $5.30 a bushel. 531 and a half the high, the low there at 524 for the August beans. September futures, 534 and a quarter the high. Low at 531 and a half, settled $5.31 and a half cents on the low. Still finished 2 cents higher. November futures, 542 the high, the low at 534 and a quarter. Settlement price at 540 and three quarters, up 2 and a quarter. And the January contract of next year. For 2006, the beans had a high of 547, a low at $5.45. Split the difference at 546 for the settlement price for the Jan 2006 contract, up a penny for the day. Bean meal now, the March contract, 158.40 the high. Low at 154.50, settled 157.90. They were up 2 even. That's $2. And the May meal, 157.30. The high, the low at 154.10, settled 157.10. They were up $1.20. Bean oil futures, 1985. The high, the low at 1961, settled 1971. They were down 3 cents for the day. And the May bean oil, $19.97. The high, the low at 1974, settled at 1981, and they were off 6 cents for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
January feeder cattle, today's high 104.55, the low 104.35, the settlement 104.50, that down a nickel. March, $100.60, the high 99.60, the low $100.05, the settlement that up 45. April, 99.80, the high 98.70, the low 99.55, the settlement that up 55. February live cattle, 89.20, the high 88.50, the low 88.77.5, the settlement that up 7.5. April, 87.70, the high 87, even the low 87.52.5, the settlement that up 57.5. April lean hogs, make that February lean hogs. Let's go back there. 75.67.5, the high today for February lean hogs. 74.57.5, the low, the settlement 75.07.5, that down 35. April 76.75, the high 75.70, the low 76.65, the settlement that up 35. May 76.50, the high 75.50, the low finishing at 76.47.5, up 17.5. June 78.50, the high 77.50, the low 78.47.5, the settlement that up 12.5. And February bellies 94.65, the high, the low 93.85, the settlement 94.15, that up 47.5. The Dow is up 108 points, the NASDAQ up 15, and the S&P 500 is 7 higher.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. Working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Lee Davis from Northport, Alabama writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I live in Alabama, which is as far from California as one can possibly be.